The Ascent of Mount Carmel, Book 3, Chapter 7, which treats of the second kind of apprehension of the memory, namely, imaginary apprehensions, and of supernatural knowledge. Although in writing of natural apprehensions of the first kind, we also gave instruction concerning the imaginary, which are likewise natural, it was well to make this division, because of the love which the memory always has for other forms and kinds of knowledge, which are of supernatural things, such as visions, revelations, locutions, and feelings which come in a supernatural way. When these things have passed through the soul, there is wont to remain impressed upon it some image, form, figure, or idea, whether in the soul or in the memory or fancy, at times very vividly and effectively. Concerning these images, it is also needful to give advice, lest the memory be encumbered by them, and they be a hindrance to its union with God in perfect and pure hope. I say that the soul, in order to attain that blessing, must never reflect upon the clear and distinct objects which may have passed through its mind by supernatural means, in such a way as to preserve within itself the forms and figures and knowledge of these things. For we must ever bear in mind this principle. The greater heed the soul gives to any clear and distinct apprehensions, whether natural or supernatural, the less capacity and preparation it has for entering into the abyss of faith, wherein are absorbed all things else. For as has been said, no supernatural forms or kinds of knowledge which can be apprehended by the memory are God, and in order to reach God, the soul must void itself of all that is not God. The memory must also strip itself of all these forms and kinds of knowledge, that it may unite itself with God in hope. For all possession is contrary to hope, which, as St. Paul says, belongs to that which is not possessed. Wherefore, the more the memory dispossesses itself, the greater is its hope, and the more it has of hope, the more it has of union with God. For with respect to God, the more the soul hopes, the more it attains. And it hopes most when it is most completely dispossessed. And when it shall be perfectly dispossessed, it will remain with the perfect possession of God in divine union. But there are many who will not deprive themselves of the sweetness and delight which memory finds in those forms and notions, wherefore they attain not to supreme possession and perfect sweetness. For he that renounces not all that he possesses cannot be the disciple of Christ. Chapter 8. Of the evils which may be caused in the soul by the knowledge of supernatural things, if it reflect upon them, says how many these evils are. The spiritual man incurs the risk of five kinds of evil if he pays heed to and reflects upon these forms and ideas which are impressed upon him by the things which pass through his mind in a supernatural way. The first is that he is frequently deceived and mistakes one thing for another. The second is that he is like to fall, and is exposed to the danger of falling into some form of presumption or vanity. The third is that the devil has many occasions of deceiving him by means of the apprehensions aforementioned. The fourth is that he is hindered as to union in hope with God. The fifth is that, for the most part, he has a low judgment of God. As to the first evil, it is clear that if the spiritual man pays heed to these forms and notions, and reflects upon them, he must frequently be deceived in his judgment of them. For as no man can have a complete understanding of the things that pass through his imagination naturally, nor a perfect and certain judgment about them, he will be much less able still to have this with respect to supernatural things, which are above our capacity to understand, and occur but rarely. Wherefore he will often think that what comes but from his fancy, pertains to God. And often, too, that what is of God is of the devil, and what is of the devil is of God. And very often there will remain with him deep-seated impressions of forms and ideas concerning the good and evil of others, or of himself, together with other figures which have been presented to him. These he will consider to be most certain and true, when in fact they will not be so, but very great falsehoods. And others will be true, and he will judge them to be false. Although this error I consider safer, as it is apt to arise from humility. And even if he be not deceived as to their truth, he may well be deceived as to their quantity or quality, thinking that little things are great and great things little. And with respect to their quality, he may consider what is in his imagination to be this or that, when it is something quite different. He may put, as Isaiah says, darkness for light and light for darkness, or bitter for sweet and sweet for bitter. And finally, even though he be correct as to one thing, it will be a marvel if he goes not astray with respect to the next. For although he may not desire to apply his judgment to the judging of them, yet if he apply it in paying heed to them, this will be sufficient to make some evil cling to him as a result of it, at least passively, if not evil of this kind, then of one of the four other kinds of which we shall shortly speak. It behoves the spiritual man, therefore, lest he fall into this evil of being deceived in his judgment, not to desire to apply his judgment in order to know the nature of his own condition or feelings, or the nature of such and such a vision, idea, or feeling. Neither should he desire to know it or to pay heed to it. This he should only desire in order to speak of it to his spiritual father, and to be taught by him how to void his memory of these apprehensions. For whatever may be their intrinsic nature, they cannot help him to love God as much as the smallest act of living faith and hope performed in the emptiness and renunciation of all things. Chapter 9. Of the second kind of evil, which is the peril of falling into self-esteem and vain presumption. The supernatural apprehensions of the memory already described are also a frequent occasion to spiritual persons of falling into some kind of presumption or vanity, if they give heed to them and set store by them. For even as he who knows nothing of them is quite free of falling into this vice, since he sees in himself no occasion of presumption, even so, in contrary wise, he that has experience of them has close at hand an occasion for thinking himself to be something, since he possesses these supernatural communications. For although it is true that he may attribute them to God, hold himself to be unworthy of them, and give God the thanks, yet nevertheless there is wont to remain in his spirit a certain secret satisfaction, and a self-esteem and a sense of their value, from which, without his knowledge, there will come to him great spiritual pride. This may be observed very clearly by such as will consider the dislike and aversion caused them by any who do not praise their spirituality, or esteem the experiences which they enjoy, and the mortification which they suffer when they think, or are told, that others have just those same experiences, or even superior ones. All this arises from secret self-esteem and pride, and they can never quite realize that they are steeped in pride up to their eyes. For they think that a certain degree of recognition of their own wretchedness suffices. And although they have this, they are full of secret self-esteem and self-satisfaction, taking more delight in their own spirituality and spiritual gifts than in those of others. They are like the Pharisee who gives thanks to God that he was not as other men, and that he practiced such and such virtues. Whereat he was satisfied with himself, and presumed thereon. Such men, although they may not use the Pharisee's actual words, habitually resemble him in spirit. And some of them even become so proud that they are worse than the devil, for observing in themselves, as they imagine, certain apprehensions and feelings concerning God which are devout and sweet, they become self-satisfied to such an extent that they believe themselves to be very near God, and that those who are not like themselves they consider very low and despise them after the manner of the Pharisee. In order to flee from this pestilent evil, abhorrent in the eyes of God, they must consider two things. First, that virtue consists not in apprehensions and feelings concerning God, however sublime they be, nor in anything of this kind that a man can feel within himself, but on the contrary, in that which has nothing to do with feeling, namely, a great humility and contempt of oneself, and of all that pertains to oneself, firmly rooted in the soul and keenly felt by it, and likewise in being glad that others feel in this very same way concerning oneself, and in not wishing to be of any account in the esteem of others. Secondly, it must be noted that all visions, revelations, and feelings coming from heaven, and any thoughts that may proceed from these, are of less worth than the least act of humility. And humility is one of the effects of charity, which esteems not its own things, nor strives to attain them, nor thinks evil save of itself, nor thinks any good thing of itself, but only of others. It is well, therefore, that these supernatural apprehensions should not attract men's eyes, but that they should strive to forget them, in order that they may be free. Chapter 10. Of the third evil that may come to the soul, from the devil, through the imaginary apprehensions of the memory. From all that has been said above, it may be clearly understood and inferred how great is the evil that may come to the soul from the devil by way of these supernatural apprehensions. For not only can he represent to the memory and the fancy many false forms and ideas which seem true and good, impressing them on spirit and sense with great effectiveness, and certifying them to be true by means of suggestion, so that it appears to the soul that it cannot be otherwise, but that everything is even as he represents it, for as he transfigures himself into an angel of light, he appears as light to the soul. But the devil may also tempt the soul in many ways with respect to true knowledge, which is of God, moving its desires and affections, whether spiritual or sensual, in unruly fashion with respect to these. For if the soul takes pleasure in such apprehensions, it is very easy for the devil to cause its desires and affections to grow within it, and to make it fall into spiritual gluttony and other evils. And in order the better to do this, he is wont to suggest and give pleasure, sweetness and delight to the senses with respect to these same things of God, so that the soul is corrupted and bewildered by the sweetness, and is thus blinded with that pleasure, and sets its eyes on pleasure rather than on love, or at least very much more than upon love, and gives more heed to the apprehensions than to the detachment and emptiness which are to be found in faith and hope and love of God. And from this, the devil may go on gradually to deceive the soul and cause it to believe his falsehoods with great facility. For to the soul that is blind, falsehood no longer appears to be falsehood, nor does evil appear to be evil, etc. For darkness appears to be light, and light darkness. and hence that soul comes to commit 1,000 foolish errors, whether with respect to natural things or to moral things or to spiritual things, so that that which was wine to it becomes vinegar. All this happens to the soul because it began not, first of all, by denying itself the pleasure of those supernatural things. At first this is a small matter, and not very harmful, and the soul has therefore no misgivings, and allows it to continue. And it grows like the grain of mustard seed into a tall tree. For a small error at the beginning, as they say, becomes a great error at the end. Wherefore, in order to flee from this great evil which comes from the devil, the soul must not desire to have any pleasure in such things, because such pleasure will surely lead it to become blind and to fall. For of their own nature, and without the help of the devil, pleasure and delight and sweetness blind the soul. And this was the meaning of David when he said, "Perhaps darkness shall blind me in my delights, and I shall have the night for my light." Chapter 11. Of the fourth evil that comes to the soul from the distinct supernatural apprehensions of the memory, which is the hindrance that it interposes to union. Concerning this fourth evil, there is not much to be said, since it has already been treated again and again in this third book, wherein we have proved how, in order that the soul may come to union with God in hope, it must renounce every possession of the memory. For in order that its hope in God may be perfect, it must have nothing in the memory that is not God. And, as we have likewise said, no form or figure or image or other kind of knowledge that may come to the memory can be God. Neither can it be like him, whether it be of heaven or of earth, natural or supernatural. Even as David teaches when he says, "Lord, among the gods there is none like unto thee." Wherefore, if the memory wishes to pay heed to any of these things, it hinders the soul from reaching God. First, because it encumbers it, and next, because the more the soul has of possession, the less it has of hope. Wherefore, it is needful for the soul to be stripped of the distinct forms and the knowledge of supernatural things, and to become oblivious to them, so that the memory may cause no hindrance to its union with God in perfect hope. Chapter 12. Of the fifth evil that may come to the soul in supernatural imaginary forms and apprehensions, which is a low and unseemly judgment of God. No less serious is the fifth evil that comes to the soul in its desire to retain in the memory and imagination the said forms and images of things that are supernaturally communicated to it, above all if it desires to use them as a means to divine union. For it is a very easy thing to judge of the being and greatness of God less worthily and nobly than befits his incomprehensible nature. For although our reason and judgment may form no express conception that God is like any one of these things, yet the very esteeming of these apprehensions, if in fact the soul esteems them, makes and causes it not to esteem God or not to feel concerning him as highly as faith teaches. Since faith tells us that he is incomparable, incomprehensible, and so forth. For quite apart from the fact that the soul takes from God all that it gives to the creature, it is natural that its esteem of these apprehensible things should lead it to make a certain inward comparison between such things and God, which would prevent it from judging and esteeming God as highly as it ought. For the creatures, whether terrestrial or celestial, and all distinct images and kinds of knowledge, both natural and supernatural, that can be encompassed by the faculties of the soul, however lofty they be in this life, have no comparison or proportion with the being of God, since God falls within no genus and no species, whereas the creatures do, or so the theologians tell us. And the soul in this life is not capable of receiving in a clear and distinct manner anything save that which falls within genus and species. For this cause, St. John says that no man hath seen God at any time. And Isaiah says, it has not entered into the heart of man what God is like. And God said to Moses that he could not see him while he was in this mortal state. Wherefore, he that encumbers his memory and the other faculties of the soul with that which they can comprehend, cannot esteem God, neither feel concerning him as he ought. Let us make a comparison on a lower level. It is clear that the more a man fixes his eyes upon the servants of a king, and the more notice he takes of them, the less notice does he take of the king himself, and the less does he esteem him. For although this comparison may not be formally and distinctly present in the understanding, it is inherent in the act, since the more attention the man gives to the servants, the more he takes from their lord. And he cannot have a very high opinion of the king if the servants appear to him to be of any importance while they are in the presence of the king their lord. Even so does the soul treat its God when it pays heed to the creatures aforementioned. This comparison, however, is on a very low level, for as we have said, God is of another being than his creatures, in that he is infinitely far from them all. For this reason they must all be banished from sight, and the soul must withdraw its gaze from them in all their forms, that it may yet gaze on God through faith and hope. Wherefore, those who not only pay heed to the imaginary apprehensions aforementioned, but suppose God to be like some of them, and think that by means of them they will be able to attain to union with God, have already gone far astray, and will ever continue to lose the light of faith in the understanding through which this faculty is united with God. Neither will they grow in the loftiness of hope, by means whereof the memory is united with God in hope, which must be brought about through disunion from all that is of the imagination. End of chapter 12.